All right, so you want to get in the know, right? Like really understand something without drowning in information. Well, that's what we do here on The Deep Dive. We go deep so you can too. And today we're taking on something that's super important, but you probably haven't ever really seen. A clinical study report, a CSR.
Exactly. You can think of a CSR like the ultimate evidence file for a whole clinical trial. We've got a medical writing team with us, and they've been deep in these reports since 1998. They know their stuff.
So much experience. What's the plan for our deep dive today? What do we really want to get out of this?
We want to understand what a CSR actually is. Why does it even matter? What goes into making one? And we're going to be using this really incisive document from that medical writing team. It's chock full of good stuff.
Okay, so first things first. What is a clinical study report? What is a CSR?
Well, the official definition, the one from the ICHE3 guideline, that's the gold standard everyone uses, says it's like a complete report of a clinical trial. All the clinical and statistical stuff, all the descriptions and analyses, and it's all in one document with tables and figures right there in the main text and in the appendices. So not just a summary, it's the whole shebang.
So it's everything, the whole trial, from start to finish. And how does this fit into the process of getting a new drug out there, getting it approved?
It's super important. The CSR is like the foundation for the whole drug development process. And when it goes to the regulators, they got to have it. The FDA, the EMA, they all use it to decide if a new treatment is safe and effective. It's got to be detailed, how the trial was run, what the results were, and then some discussion about what it all means.
Okay, so it's the big evidence package that goes to the people making the decisions. So before anyone even starts writing this huge report, what needs to happen first? What are the steps?
Oh, there's a bunch of things you got to do before you even think about writing. First, you got to gather all the docs you're going to need. Kind of like getting all your research together before you write a big paper. And there's actually a whole checklist for this. Pro tip, ask for the Microsoft Word versions of everything if you can. Makes life so much easier when you're writing and editing.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. What kind of documents are we talking about here?
So we're talking about the protocol, obviously, and any amendments to it that happened during the trial. The statistical analysis plan, that's important. It lays out how they're going to crunch the numbers. And then even some sample case report forms, those show how the individual patient data was collected. Basically, anything that shows how the trial was supposed to run and what data they got. Then the team, they got to figure out how closely they're going to follow those ICHE3 guidelines. There's a lot of detail in there.
Right.
And you absolutely need a solid template for the document, one that already has all the main ICHE3 stuff baked in, saves a ton of time. And of course, always got to keep up with the latest regulatory stuff. Those requirements can change.
So it's all about being organized, knowing the rules, and having a standard way of doing things.
Right.
Now, let's say the data starts coming in. When do you actually start writing this CSR?
You know, the best thing to do is start writing as soon as you have the data, even a little bit before if you can. Waiting to write the report can really mess things up.
Oh, how so?
Well, the team, you know, the people who did the trial, they might move on to other projects. So if you have questions later, it's hard to find them. Plus, the longer you wait, the more you got to refresh your memory on the whole trial. And that just takes more time.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing, I think, is that when you look at data later, after a while, you might see it differently than you would have right away.
Oh, that's really interesting. Your perspective can actually change. So start early. What else helps make writing a CSR successful?
Getting everyone on the same page about who's doing what right from the start. Everyone needs to know their role and when things are due, like who's writing which section of the report.
Yeah.
And then you got to set clear milestones and deadlines.
Yeah.
And everyone needs to agree on those, you know, all the stakeholders. That insider document, they talk about this problem. Getting feedback on a CSR when the trial team's already busy with their next thing.
Oh, yeah.
Happens all the time.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So communication, planning, really important stuff. Now, you've mentioned this ICHE3 thing a few times, the guidelines. Can you tell us more about, like, the rules around CSRs?
Of course. Actually, the rule about making CSRs is in the ICH Good Clinical Practice Guideline. That's E6R3, specifically section 3.17.2.
Specific.
Right. So it says sponsors have to write these reports and send them to the regulators for trials that are finished or stopped early or even just for interim analyses. And as we've been talking about, ICHE3, that's the main guide for what goes in these reports and how they're structured.
And these guidelines, they've been around for a while, right?
Oh, yeah. They go way back, almost 30 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time for a regulatory guideline.
It is.
But they're not set in stone. In 2012, they added a Q&A, you know, questions and answers to clarify things. And what they said was ICHE3 is a guideline, not a strict template. It's there to help you write a good, clear report. So that's why a lot of companies use their own CSR templates. They take those ICH guidelines and tweak them to fit how they work.
Right.
Makes it easier.
So it's a framework, but there's flexibility. You mentioned earlier that CSRs aren't just for regulators. Who else uses them?
Yeah, so there's this big push for transparency in research now.
Mm-hmm.
So CSRs are being shared publicly more and more. Of course, when they're made public, some stuff has to be taken out, you know, redacted. Yeah. Sensitive info like details about the drug itself or how the trial was run or patient data. But the important thing is that whatever's taken out can't mess up the scientific value of the data. They got to keep the data useful.
So it's finding that balance between protecting privacy and being transparent. Mm-hmm. Have there been any changes in the rules lately that affect CSRs?
Definitely. Brexit, you know, the UK leaving the EU, that changed things.
Nah.
And the EU rolled out their clinical trials regulation, the CTR, in 2022. That applies to all new and ongoing trials in the EU. So since CSRs are the main summary of the trial results, those rules about what goes in them and how they're shared, they're all affected by the CTR. And then there's the UK's MHRA, their regulatory agency. They became a full member of ICH in 2022. So we're probably going to see some changes to their rules too, which will likely affect CSRs that are submitted in the UK.
So things are always evolving.
Always.
Okay, let's talk about the practical stuff, like scheduling, making a timeline for writing one of these reports. How do you even start?
You got to make a realistic timeline, one that everyone can actually stick to. And that means everyone on the team needs to be on board with the plan. Now, how long it takes to write a CSR, that really depends on the trial. Simple trials can be quicker than a really complex one. And of course, the more data there is, the longer it's going to take. And then you got to factor in the experience of the medical writer, you know, how good they are at their job.
Right, that makes sense.
So it's hard to say exactly how long it should take.
But are there like any averages, any general idea?
Well, there was this study by EMWA, that's the European Medical Writers Association. They looked into this.
Okay.
And they found that for like a mid-level phase three trial, the average time to write the first draft of the CSR after they got the final tables and figures and all, you know, the TFLs, mm-hmm. it was about 17 working days. But that's just an average. Some took way less time. Some took almost 2 months. So it really varies. And, you know, what they found and what our insider source says, too, is that the biggest holdup usually isn't the writing itself. It's the time it takes to get feedback and approval from the client.
Ah, so the back and forth can take a while.
Yeah, it can.
So what are some ways to keep things on track?
One thing that helps is breaking the CSR down into smaller chunks with deadlines for each part. So you're not just staring at this massive document. For example, you could do what's called a front-end shell of the report. That's all the methodology, all the administrative details about the trial. You right. can do that before you even have all the data. But our insider source, they're very clear. Don't try to rush things by using draft data, preliminary stuff. You'll just end up with errors that take forever to fix later.
Better to be accurate than fast?
Exactly.
What about that synopsis at the beginning of the report? When do you write that?
You know, it's actually better to wait till the very end to do that 3 to 10 page synopsis. It doesn't take that long to write. And if you do it early, it might not match the final content of the report, and then you got to fix it.
Oh, that's smart. So you build the main thing first and then summarize it. You mentioned this shell idea. Can you break that down a bit more? What exactly is a CSR shell?
So think of it like the skeleton of the report. It's the methods, the administrative stuff, the details of the trial, basically the first half of the whole document.
Okay.
And to build this shell, you need a bunch of documents. The report template, the final protocol with any amendments, any important file notes, the trial procedures manual, the statistical analysis plan, you know, that SAP, details from clinicaltrials.gov, info about the ethics committee and the monitor and the labs, any sponsor SOPs and style guides. That's a lot.
Sounds like it.
It is.
So what's the benefit of doing all that up front?
Once the team's reviewed and signed off on the shell, it's pretty much done. Locked down.
Okay.
And then the writers can focus on the results part of the report once the data is ready. Now, what sections are in the shell, that depends on the trial and the template you're using. But usually you'll have a section about the people in the trial, the demographics, then safety, pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, the efficacy data, and sometimes more specific stuff like pharmacogenetics or biomarker analyses.
What if you have different experts writing different sections?
Oh, yeah, that happens a lot. You get a deeper dive into each area that way, but then you got to make sure everything fits together smoothly. The flow has to make sense. The writing style needs to be consistent. Got to make sure the cross references between sections are all good.
Yeah, it has to read as one document.
Exactly.
Okay, so you've got the data. The shell is done. How do you go about presenting and talking about the results, the actual findings of the trial?
The main thing is to present the key findings, the stuff that's been carefully picked out and summarized from the tables, figures, and listings, the TFLs. And you got to clearly point out any deviations from the protocol, you know, when they didn't follow the plan exactly. And it's super important to be objective. Just present the facts. Don't just say see Appendix X. Actually summarize the key data right there in the main report.
That makes it much easier to understand.
Right.
What about analyses that weren't planned? Like, they decided to do them after the trial started.
Ah, you're talking about post hoc analyses. Those always have to be clearly labeled and put in a separate section. The main part of the report should focus on what they planned to analyze before they saw the data.
Okay.
And if you do include post hoc analyses, you got to explain why you did them. You know, the section where you talk about changes to the trial or the analyses.
That makes sense. And then there's the discussion section. That seems pretty important. What's the main goal of that section? How do you approach writing it?
So the discussion isn't just repeating the results, you know, what you already said.
Yeah.
And you can't bring in any new data that wasn't in the results section. The goal of the discussion is to really think about the findings, how they relate to the objectives of the trial, what they were trying to show. And you got to be factual. No speculating, no over-the-top language, no exaggerating the importance of the findings. Just stick to what the data says.
So a balanced, objective view. What else makes a good discussion section?
You got to think about any problems that came up during the trial. Highlight the most important findings. Talk about the potential benefits of the treatment. But always put the results in the context of the whole development program for the drug. And talking to the rest of the project team is really important here. They got the bigger picture.
Yeah.
They can help you understand the stats, the PK data.
Yeah.
And the investigator's brochure, that's helpful too. It's got all the background info on the drug. But our insider source, they say be careful about referencing too much published literature, you know, other research papers. That can make it look like you're trying to read too much into your own data or you're speculating too much.
That's a good point. So you use different types of information in different ways. Now, there are different types of clinical trials. So does that mean there are different types of CSRs?
Absolutely. A full CSR, that's the most common. And that's usually what you need for regulatory approval. But ICHE3, it actually says that abbreviated study reports may be acceptable in certain cases. And our insider document, it goes into more detail about this. They talk about four main types of CSRs.
Okay, let's go through them. What's a type 1 CSR?
That's the full one, the full clinical study report. What we've been talking about mostly, it covers everything, efficacy, safety, the whole nine yards. That's what you usually need for getting a drug approved or for the product labeling.
Okay, so that's the gold standard. What about type 2?
Type 2 is a supplemental clinical study report. It gives you more details on top of the full CSR. Doesn't necessarily have all the same sections as the type 1, though. It often refers back to the main CSR. And you use it for things like analyses that were planned but weren't the main focus, or unplanned analyses, or when you're looking at data across multiple trials.
So it's like an add-on, a follow-up to the main report. What about type 3?
Type 3 is the abbreviated clinical study report. Shorter, as you might guess. You use this for trials that aren't meant to be the main evidence for an efficacy claim. So maybe for a different dose or a different type of patient or a different indication. It's got a shorter methodology and efficacy section compared to the full one, but the safety data is usually still pretty comprehensive.
Okay, and lastly, what's a type 4 CSR?
That's the synoptic clinical study report. This one gives you a summary of the key points. What happened to the participants, any clinical pharmacology stuff, efficacy data. It can be used in different situations, like for trials of different indications or doses that aren't being registered, early stage trials that are just looking at safety and tolerability, trials that had problems, uncontrolled trials, trials that weren't finished, even just the summary at the end of a project. And one thing about synoptic reports, they usually don't have tables in the main text unless it's really important info, like details about the drug or serious adverse events. Oh, in the FDA, they have their own specific guidance on abbreviated and synoptic reports too.
So there's a whole range of report types depending on the trial. Now, let's zoom in on one section, pharmacokinetics. What are some good ways to present those results in a CSR?
The best way to do the PK section is to start with the most basic data, the stuff that hasn't been messed with too much. So you'd usually start with the raw plasma concentration data over time, maybe show it as a graph that gives you a clear picture of how the drug is absorbed, distributed, metabolized, excreted, all that stuff.
Right.
Then you'd report the key PK parameters, Cmax, Tmax, AUC, T1/2. Those are usually calculated using non-compartmental analysis or PK modeling. And then you summarize those parameters using the right statistical methods like geometric means, coefficients of variation, and you compare them across different doses or groups of patients if you can.
What about more complex analyses of the PK data?
Right, so after the basic parameters, you'd move on to secondary analyses like, is the drug exposure proportional to the dose? It's a bioequivalence trial. How do the different formulations compare? Does the drug build up in the body with repeated dosing? And then you got to look at the PK data alongside the safety data. Are there any connections between drug levels and adverse events? Any concentrated QTC issues? Any exposure response relationships? You got to look at all that stuff.
So you start basic and then get more and more in depth. Okay, we've talked about some best practices for writing a CSR, but can you give us like a summary, a list of the most important things to keep in mind?
Sure. So number one, start early. Get that shell done and agree on how the data is going to be presented. And it's often a good idea to start writing with the demographic section or the safety section. That helps you understand the trial better. You got to remember, writing a CSR is basically project management. You're coordinating info from all these different sources, the protocol, the SAP, the TFLs. It's a lot to juggle.
Project management for writing. That's a good way to put it. What else is important?
You got to be on top of any deviations from the protocol. Were they minor deviations? Not a big deal. Or major ones that could affect the data or patient safety. You got to document everything. Sometimes you even need a whole narrative for a participant if there was a big deviation. And communication is key all the time. Talk to the team, make sure everyone knows what's going on, and get those appendix documents early. Don't wait till the last minute. That will just delay things.
Good advice. What about the discussion and conclusions? Any tips for those sections?
For the discussion, always focus on the disease area and what the drug did, and use the data from the CSR to back up what you're saying. No making stuff up, no wild claims. The conclusions should be bullet points, clear and to the point, addressing the objectives of the trial and the main endpoints. I can't say it enough. Get those appendix documents early.
Got it. Now, what about the appendices? What goes in there?
The appendices, that's section 16 of the CSR, according to ICH-E3. You put all the detailed trial info in there, all the raw data for each participant, and examples of the case report forms. Now, that ICH Q&A from 2012, that clarified some things. You don't need every single supporting document in the appendices, like investigator CVs or ethics approvals, as long as they're in the trial master file. The point is to keep the appendices manageable. Don't stuff them with unnecessary stuff, like multiple translations of the same document. And one more thing, especially in the EU with their public disclosure rules, they often move detailed info about people involved in the trial to the appendices to protect their privacy.
Right. Makes sense. So how is the data actually presented?
Usually in one of three ways. Tables, figures, or listings. Tables are good for summaries and analyzed data with all the stats. Figures, they're more visual, good for highlighting key findings. And data listings, those show you the individual data points for each participant. You can use those when you're talking about specific examples in the main text.
So each format has its purpose. You mentioned some insights from an experienced medical writer. What were some of the key things they learned?
One thing they said was don't just copy and paste the trial design from the protocol into the CSR. You got to really think about it, make sure it's accurate and presented well, especially in light of the results. And they said to focus on the primary and secondary endpoints. Those are the most important findings. The discussion to deep. That can be tricky, especially when you're dealing with biomarker data. You really got to work with the whole team to understand it. And overall, they stress clarity and attention to detail. Time management is crucial too, knowing how to prioritize and when to ask for help. You got to be proactive, think ahead, and communicate well with the whole team.
Sounds like a demanding but important job. So let's talk about transparency. There's a big push for that these days. How has that affected CSRs?
It's had a huge impact. Now you got to have a lay summary of the protocol available to the public while the trial is still running. And this whole transparency thing really picked up steam with the FDA Modernization Act in 1997. That helped create clinical trial registries like clinicaltrials.gov. You've got other registries too, like ISRCTN in the UK and the EMA's CTIS in Europe. They all make info about trials public. And then in 2005, the ICMJE, they said journals can't publish research unless the trial's registered.
So more and more information is becoming public.
Yeah, definitely. And then the FDA Amendments Act of 2007. That made it mandatory to register summary info for a lot of trials. And since 2007, there have been more and more requirements to upload results to clinicaltrials.gov, especially for approved drugs. Then the FDA's final rule in 2017 that said even trials for drugs that haven't been approved yet, their results are going to be public too.
A big change in how things are done. Now, to keep things consistent and high quality, style guides are really important, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Style guides are great. They make sure everyone's using the same language, the same terms, the same formatting, and that makes everything clearer and easier to read. And it makes the whole process more efficient. You spend less time fixing things. These guides can be simple, like a list of do's and don'ts, or super detailed, covering everything about medical writing. They really help speed things up and make sure everything's good quality.
Can you give us an example of what these guidelines might look like?
Sure. Our insider document has this example from a fictional company. They call it Submission Writing Conventions for Niche's Sparkling Lemonade. It shows how specific these guides can be. Like, they always call the product the lemonade. They use a specific template. They have an in-house style guide everyone has to follow. They even say what words to use, like participant instead of subject or patient. They have rules about capitalization, UK versus US spelling, number formatting, abbreviations, everything. Even spacing and hyphens and bullet points. They want everything to be consistent.
Wow, they think of everything. So we've talked about the regulations, the push for public access, all that. How has all this affected how we think about CSRs?
Well, they used to be pretty hidden. You know, all that data was locked away. But now it's all about openness and access. The EMA's policy 0070 on publishing clinical data, that's a big example of this change. They put it on hold for a while, but they brought it back in 2024, and it's going to expand even more in 2025. And one key part of this policy is that you have to write summaries of the trial results in plain language so the public can understand them.
Those are the lay summaries, right?
Exactly. The EMA and the UK's HRA, they both require these now. They want the public to have access to this info. The summary is going to cover 10 specific things, and they got to be posted on the EU clinical trials portal within a certain time frame, usually 12 months after the trial ends. There are some exceptions for certain types of trials.
So it's really about empowering the public. Okay, last topic. Patient-reported outcomes, how are those being included in CSRs?
PROs, those are becoming really important. They tell you directly what the patient is experiencing, their symptoms, side effects, how well they're functioning, their quality of life. In the past, trials focused more on what doctors could measure, like lab tests or how the disease was progressing. But now the FDA and the EMA, they want to see more PROs. They're often key secondary endpoints, sometimes even co-primary endpoints, especially for chronic conditions, you know, where symptoms are a big deal.
So it's about getting the patient's perspective.
Exactly. And when you're designing a trial that includes PROs, you got to be clear about what you're measuring, why you chose those measures, what tools you're using to collect the data, like questionnaires and how you're going to analyze it. Those tools, they got to be validated, you know, make sure they're accurate and relevant for the patients you're studying. And then in the CSR, you present the PRO results along with the other efficacy and safety data. Even if the main outcomes, like tumor size, don't change much, if the patients are reporting less pain or feeling better, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It can really affect how well they stick to the treatment and their overall well-being. Our insider document gives us a great example from oncology. You might have a cancer treatment that keeps the tumor from growing, which is good, but it also significantly reduces pain. That's huge for the patient. And you'd capture that with PROs.
So PROs give you a more complete picture.
Right. And they make the whole process more patient-centered.
This has been a fantastic deep dive. CSRs, they're not just boring documents. They tell the story of a whole clinical trial.
Yeah, they're complex, that's for sure. But they're super important. They're what regulators use. And they're becoming more and more important for transparency, too. It takes a lot of planning and attention to detail to write a good one. You got to follow the rules, and everyone on the team needs to be on the same page.
It's amazing how much information is in these reports, and it seems like they're only going to become more accessible to everyone.
That's right. And that raises a question for you, our listener. How do you think this increased transparency, this access to CSRs, is going to change how we understand medical treatments? How is it going to empower patients?
That's something to think about. If you want to learn more, check out those ICH guidelines or take a look at clinicaltrials.gov. They've got a ton of information on there. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.